Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and today we're going to start a new book. And you can find our stuff at vnnforum.com. The new book is going to be The Enemy of Europe by Francis Parker Yockey. And this is something that he wrote shortly after Imperium, I believe. And I've got the sort of a Z design, blue on white on the front. The Enemy of Europe, and then there's a long critical response by Revelo Oliver. The Enemy of Our Enemies is his response to The Enemy of Europe. So two enemies, enemies. A lot of enemy in these two titles. These two are collected and published as one book by Liberty Bell Publications back in 1981. Says translated by Thomas Francis from the German translation of Yockey's Lost Original. So I don't know, maybe there's more than what there is. But first paperback printing November 1981, reprinted with corrections November 1985, republished August 2003, ISBN 0-942094-00-2. Copyright 1981 by Thomas Francis. Liberty Bell Publications, P.O. Box 890, York, South Carolina, 29745. No idea if that's still valid. Suspect it might not be, but anyway, it's about a 100-page book, if you want to call it that, followed by about a 140 to 50-page response from Oliver. We'll do both of them as one unit. We'll do the Yockey portion in about four segments, and the Revelo Oliver in probably about six or so, five or six. Anyway, The Enemy of Europe by Francis Parker Yockey. To the memory of the founder of the Francis Parker Yockey Society, Louis T. Byers, B-Y-E-R-S, an Aryan of the Aryans who also fought a good fight to its tragic end, 22 October 1981. Flip the page. There's a hitherto unpublished photograph taken at about the time he finished Imperium in 1948, somewhat saturnine-looking fellow, and began working its sequel, The Enemy of Europe, Francis Parker Yockey. And he actually looks about, well, of course it's easy to project, he looks about like someone who would write Imperium, like he doesn't really see what's there, he sees something much deeper and farther, or at least that's what he affects. And then there's a second photograph on the facing page. Francis Parker Yockey, 1917 to 1960, on his way to the prison in which he would be found dead, reportedly a suicide. So, contents, and he's got four, he does it kind of the way he does Imperium, and he's got four sections. The morphology of the Second World War, the metapolitics of the war, the morphology of the Third World War, and finally, the politics of Europe. Those are the four sections. We're going to do section one today. And before that, there's an introductory note we'll also do. So flipping the page to page one, introductory note. These thoughts were intended to form part of my book, Imperium, but for personal reasons, that was not possible. They owe their present incarnation to the fact that many of those to whom that work was really addressed were unable to draw offhand the necessary conclusions. In this treatise, as in Imperium, there is nothing personal, and thus here as there, I refrain from entering the debate over political tactics. Such matters are better discussed orally. Organic laws constitute the vernacular of politics. With Imperium, my aim was to present those laws so that everybody who somehow identified his personal destiny, as it were, with the destiny of Europe, could draw his own conclusions from the basic principles and select his own tactics. Some people misunderstood this possibility to such an extent that they regarded the presentation of these organic laws as just another contribution to the usual political theoretical discussion. Therefore, the organic laws are more fully elaborated here in that they are applied to the world situation of the moment to help provide the worthiest minds with a clearer insight into it and to unmask the enemy of Europe. Politics, history, life, destiny, heed no system. And this is part of his, he's saying life is organic and it can't be reduced to writing something down on a piece of paper. And yet he's not above, you know, he's got his little plans like everybody else. So you say that it's all right. and you're really smart. Yet if Europeans would take an active part in the world power struggle now, more than ever before, they must put their politics on an intellectual basis, for no physical force whatever is available to them. They must outwit the enemy at every turn, outplay him, until years later they will eventually be in a position to dictate conditions and compel fulfillment of them. The organic laws are presented here in the form of an intellectual exercise from which may be evolved a method of evaluating events, possibilities, decisions. A grammar that proves inadequate can be revised, but every branch of thought advances only when it has a grammar at its disposal. So he's setting up he's articulating a system for understanding what's going on, a sort of a framework for, you know what I think about the European fulfilling its destiny, what I think about its destiny and the idea of a supernatural organ being a high culture. You know about that from what I wrote in Imperium. Now I'm going to give you, maybe you didn't understand how to translate that into real world work. Now I'm going to give you a framework for judging, evaluating, and deciding what to do, and creating a grammar, as he calls it. This treatise was written from beginning to end in the year 1948, so right after he finished Imperium. Only two passages on Japan and Russia have undergone revision. The latter of the two, as can be readily perceived, was modified when in the past year, 1952, okay, well, I guess he's revising it then, Russia gave its politics a new orientation. Both passages contain not a word that Imperium, composed in 1947, does not also contain. Each day it is reconfirmed that Japan emerged from the Second World War victorious, as was noted in Imperium. Russia's break with Jewry marks the beginning of the end of Bolshevism. It is called forth by the true religious Russia, which abhors politics and technics, and which has been dominated by Petrinism, the guy who tried to westernize Russia, and Muscovite Bolshevism alike. Okay, he's saying true religious Russia abhors politics and technics and has been dominated by Petrinism, Peter the Great system, and Muscovite Bolshevism alike. So those were two sort of elite, superficial stratum imposed on the true deep religious peasantry of Russia, which has very different attitudes. Of course, this break was only a beginning, but the final inner collapse of Bolshevism is unavoidable. The possibility, indeed I must say the inevitability, of the destruction of Bolshevism by the true Russian, or true Russia, is posited in Imperium. The enemy of Europe is complete in itself, and its thesis in regard to the nature of America is true without qualification. Having lived for several decades in America, I've seen with my own eyes the distorted development of that country since the Revolution of 1933. For the most part, the resistance to the progressive distortion of America is merely passive, the resistance which any material whatever opposed to that which is acting upon it. Where the resistance is active, and the dimensions of such resistance are scanty, it finds little support, since idealism and heroism do not flourish in an attitude wherein economics is the ruling spirit. Europe can attach no hope to this resistance in America. For practical political purposes, the white America, which still existed in its strength in the 1920s, has today ceased to exist. Whether that submerged spirit will rise again in some remote future is unforeseeable. In any case, Europe cannot allow itself the luxury of dreaming that a revolution in America by the pro-European elements will lead to Europe's liberation. Europeans are familiar with America's propaganda for export, but less familiar with its internal propaganda. This propaganda utterly dwarfs in its scale as well as its effect anything Europeans can readily imagine. The Washington regime's leading internal thesis, which has not changed since 1933, is that America must be tolerant of the alien elements, which now number roughly 50% of the population. And again, he's writing this well before the 1965 Immigration Act. Since, after all, these aliens are, quote, brothers, unquote. Brotherhood is glorified on all public occasions by all public officials, is taught in the schools and preached in the churches, which have been coordinated into the master plan of the culturally alien Washington regime through tax threats. As much as anything. Newspapers, books, magazines, radio, television, films, all vomit forth the same brotherhood. The brotherhood propaganda is a ghastly caricature of the Christian idea of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, but there is no religious intent to the propaganda. Its sole purpose is to destroy whatever exclusiveness, national feelings, or racial instincts may still remain in the American population after 20 years of national leprosy. Just imagine what he would say about today. The result of the Tolerance and Brotherhood campaign is that the alien enjoys a superior position in America. He can demand to be tolerated. Again, he's writing all this before affirmative action and before the opening of the borders. That same spirit was already in place. It hadn't fully manifested itself socially and legally. The American can demand nothing. The tragic fact is that the attenuation of the national instincts has proceeded so far that one cannot envision how a nationalist revolution would even be possible in America. So long as America was dominated by men of stocks from a culture European soil, America was a European colony, even though sometimes vocally rebellious. But the America that has been distorted by the Revolution of 1933, and he never once uses the term FDR, is lost to Europe. He calls it the American Revolution of 1933, just as he has the European Revolution of 1933. Never uses FDR, never uses Nazis, rarely uses Jews, and more often uses culture distorters to mean Jews, essentially. But the America that has been distorted by the Revolution of 1933 is lost to Europe. Let no European dream of help or cooperation from that quarter. What has occurred in the world since the publication of Imperium, how the inner development of Europe has progressed, makes it clearer than ever that the world outlook and heroic ethic manifested here are the only thing that yet offers Europe a hope of fulfilling its mighty destiny. And that's the end of the introductory note. And so we're going to do the first section. It's about 25 pages, or it'll take us up to through page 23, I believe. Let me see here. Yes, through page 23. 1 to 23 is what we'll do in this section. So it's not going to be super long, but it'll be the first of four segments. Now, the first section is called The Morphology of the Second World War. First chapter, the first interbellum period, 1919 to 1930. All wars are in some way related to politics, and the aim of politics is to obtain power. If a state emerges from a war with less power at its disposal than it had at the beginning of the war, then it has lost the war. Whose troops return from the battlefield and whose troops lie dead in it does not matter. Military victory may involve real political victory, or it may not. Incidents outside the military arena can transform a mere military victory into an actual political defeat. Thus it happened that the chief losers in the First World War were England and Germany. The chief victor was Japan. It won no military victory, of course, for the simple reason that it had not actively participated in the conflict. Russia, directly after its revolutionary transformation, found itself in a position that gave it an enormous increase of power since Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been eliminated as Europe's great powers. America was a political victor, but lacking political experience and a leader stratum, it was completely unable to consolidate its new power position. Hence, it had to abandon most of its winnings. Germany's losses are obvious. Loss of 20% of its territory, complete loss of its foreign credits and its colonial empire, loss of the greater part of its rolling stock and its mineral wealth, loss of its prestige. It was robbed of everything under the Versailles Dictate. But England had to resign itself to even greater losses. To America, it completely lost its influence in the Western Hemisphere and, just as completely, its former supremacy at sea. To Russia, it had to surrender its position in Central Asia. To Japan and America, its power position in the Pacific. And to the Colored World Revolution, its international prestige. The war undermined the British Empire, and more particularly, it thoroughly undermined the British Raj. Led by revolutionaries like Gandhi, the subject peoples of India began to take matters into their own hands. Soon the white rulers discovered that their voice had lost its authority. They saw themselves forced to negotiate at every moment with the active, awakened native population, and, both personally and officially, they had to learn to behave with great circumspection. Similar things occurred among the subjugated peoples of Europe's other colonial powers. Everywhere in the colored world, the white European lost power and prestige. In this matter, not only did the two leading European states, England and Germany, lose the war, but so did the entire Western culture, although that organism in toto had not participated militarily in it. Neutral Holland thus suffered a political defeat in the war, proving once again that political defeat does not depend on military defeat. In the case of France, political and military victory coincided. Before the war, France was the weakest of the great powers. In the 1920s, it was the master of Europe. Indeed, it felt itself able once more to play the role of Napoleon, the opposition vis-a-vis England, and during the transitory political hegemony of France over continental Europe, the diplomatic struggle between France and England was the most dynamic on earth. The temporary supremacy of France during the interbellum period shows the nature of power. Ultimately, power depends on inner qualities. Mere possession of fleets, weapons, and masses of troops cannot provide a safeguard for power. Such things are only appurtenances of power, and possession of them is not its source. Within the political world, power is constantly in motion. There are strong but shallow currents of power which can temporarily work against the deeper, truer, farther-aiming power currents. France was, in regard to its military, industrial, and natural resources, to all appearances absolutely secure in Europe for the immediate future. In 1923, ignoring England's protests, it undertook a military invasion of Germany. At that time, two German thinkers were discussing the European situation. When the one expressed his opinion that within a decade Germany would again be the center of gravity in European politics, the other was a, quote, realist, unquote, rudely broke off the conversation. Hermann Kaiserling was realist enough to recognize reality. Any banker's apprentice can do that. But Spengler was thinking of the source of power in Europe, of the destiny of Western civilization. During the 1930s, French mastery over... Basically what he's saying is reality records what has happened in the past, but the future belongs to those with the imagination to shape it. During the 1930s, French mastery over Europe dwindled away like a morning mist. There was no great crisis at that time, no epical war. The very fact of the European Revolution of 1933 dissolved French hegemony without a struggle, without a trace of hostilities. France's position was due solely to material factors, to simple control of the apparatus of power. The inner qualities of the regime that had this power at its disposal were not equal to asserting it and preserving it. This regime was the bearer of a no-world hypothesis. Again, this regime was the bearer of no world hypothesis, no idea, no ethic. Its dynamism was a crude desire for mastery. It utterly lacked the feeling of a super-personal mission, lacked a world outlook, a European hypothesis. When it was confronted with the European Revolution of 1933, its power simply evaporated. Bayonets can give one neither a good conscience nor the inner imperative to rule. The vassals defected, and France suddenly found itself in the position of a vassal vis-a-vis England. The choice of its lord and master was the last formal act testifying to the political existence of France as a nation. A nation is simply an idea, not a mass of people, not even the form into which the mass has been shaped. This form is the expression of the idea, and the idea is primary. Before the idea, there is no nation. When the idea has fulfilled itself, the nation has disappeared forever. It matters not whether custom, form, nomenclature, diplomacy, and the material apparatus of power remain to convince yesterday romantics that the nation survives. The Holy Roman Empire survived as a form until 1806. But as a political fact, it has ceased to exist with the decay of the power of the Hohenstaufens after the Battle of Lugano in 1176. However, in politics, facts, not claims, not names, nor legalistic fictions, are normative. In religious times, in an age of faith, men may again use in the realm of politics words that have long ceased to describe facts. But in this age of absolute politics, political fictions have lost their charm for stronger minds, no less than their effectiveness. The death of a nation is a ponderable, an event that must come to expression, and its when, with a capital W, can be foreseen with sufficient accuracy to be made the basis of long-range policy. A nation shows that it is dying when it ceases to believe in its mission and its superiority. That's worth remembering. It begins to hate everything new and everything that would drive it forward. It looks about and seeks to make defensive preparations in every direction. No longer does it strive to enlarge, but is content merely to maintain its power position. To preserve power, however, one must continually increase it. A nation need not die tumultuously in a great military defeat. As a rule, nations die quite peacefully, sinking deeper and deeper into sterile conservatism and shrinking back more and more from great decisions. Next chapter, the liquidation of English sovereignty. English policy was senile already at the beginning of Joseph Chamberlain's career in government. Even his grand idea of English, German, American world hegemony, though still a forceful, virile, aggressive policy, was basically static. Behind it lay the age-old dream of bringing history finally to a close. After Chamberlain's time, English policy became completely toothless, and names like Grey, Lloyd George, MacDonald, and Baldwin show the depths of the descent into national oblivion when compared with names from more youthful days: Walpole, Pitt, Castlereagh, Canning, Gladstone. The great empire builders were eager for every large conquest. Their dim successors indulged in lamentations over the status quo, expanding their feeble energies on protecting it from young and virile aggressors. These pallbearers of the empire tried to build a wall against history by describing politics in terms of law. The status quo is legal. Every change therein, however, is illegal. Political dynamism is illegal. In quotes, power relationships must be continued as they were at the time of the Versailles Dictate. After Versailles, England no longer had the national political energy to increase its power. Hence, everybody was to be morally prohibited from doing so, and this moral coercion was codified in sacred treaties, which were signed on the muzzles of cannon. To maintain England's political supremacy was, quote, moral and legal. Respect for international morality and the sanctity of treaties, in quotes, it was called. Quote, observing international law, orderly procedure in international relations, and similar political absurdities were promulgated. What they couldn't keep by power and energy, they were going to keep by moralizing. Clever phrases. This was not the first time that one engaged in politics in order to put politics in legalistic wrappings. The politician who resorts to law and morality to disguise his power position is suffering from a bad political conscience, and the politician or the state with a bad conscience is decadent. Ascendant politics is not afraid of being politics. Decadent politics passes itself off as religion, law, morality, science, in short, anything other than politics. Of course, England's attempt to impose its form on the world by the simple trick of employing legalistic jargon was completely futile. Only the English population was deceived thereby, just as later with the propaganda about the invulnerability of Singapore. But on the power currents of the world, which reflect the development of superpersonal organisms, the jargon had no effect whatsoever. from the original standpoint of regarding the status quo as inviolable, only insofar as the English power position was concerned, one went on to that of regarding the status quo everywhere as sacrosanct. Thus, English policy, in complete distortion of England's interests, was made to support the Serbian, Romanian, and Bohemian states against the power currents that were destined to destroy those artificial political structures. The cost of a distorted policy must be set high. The state with the distorted policy can gain no accretion of power, thus even its military and diplomatic victories are defeats. During the third decade of the 20th century, England gradually handed over its sovereignty to America in order to continue pursuing its distorted policy, a policy devoted to the worldwide preservation of the status quo. Naturally, such an unpleasant fact was not admitted by the representatives of a certain mentality, and, naturally again, those who bore the responsibility for the transfer of power shied away from defining the new relationship precisely, for had they done so, the whole policy would have been spoilt. Nevertheless, when Baldwin announced in 1936 that he would not deploy the English fleet without consulting America beforehand, he informed the entire political world in unmistakable terms that the end of English independence had come, that English sovereignty had passed over to America. Independence means being able to act alone. Sovereignty means being answerable to nobody except oneself. Neither independence nor sovereignty was characteristic of the English government that started the Second World War with its declaration of war on Germany in September 1939. When a nation loses its sovereignty, any foreign peoples and territories it controls pass, of organic necessity, into the sphere of powers that are sovereign. Thus Denmark, for example, as a result of the Second World War, was absorbed into the American world system. This occurred quite automatically. It was simply a process of the organic law of the political plenum, which ordains that a power vacuum in the political world is an impossibility. A state is not to be regarded as a power unless it can make decisions alone. Units like Switzerland are artificial structures whose raison d'etre is to serve as buffers for the adjacent powers, and thus owe their existence to the mutual jealousy of those powers. They are anomalies that can exist only so long as their territory has no particular strategic value for the surrounding great powers. During the 19th century, Switzerland was exactly the opposite of a power vacuum. It was the point of convergence for the powers surrounding it, and was likewise penetrated by the power currents surrounding them. The statecraft of the Swiss, quote, politician, unquote, consisted in abstaining from all politics and in dodging all decisions. As soon as Switzerland ceased, in 1945, to be the convergence point for the bordering powers, that very moment it became an American vassalage, without hopes, wishes, fears, or even official recognition of its status. Throughout the 19th century, the Netherlands was only an English bridgehead on the continent, first against France until about 1865, then against Prussian Germany. The Netherlands had no sovereignty, and its military forces stood at England's disposal, very tactless though it would have been to speak about this in England or its protectorate. The simple, terrifying truth is that, through the diplomacy of its leaders, beginning with Lloyd George, England lost its independence, parted with its established mode of political conduct, and passed into the same vassal-like relation vis-à-vis America into which, say, Holland or Norway had passed vis-à-vis England in the 19th century. It is utterly pointless to connect the national demise of England with the complete fecklessness of the parliamentary government in the age of absolute politics, to attempt to construct a causal relationship out of it. For nations have a certain time span before them, and their political phase also has an organically predetermined rhythmic course. Material factors have nothing to do with the greater movements of the power currents within the political world. The merely ephemeral supremacy of France in the 1920s, based solely upon material factors, is the best example of this in recent times. Next chapter is Origins of the War. To understand the origins and the morphology of the Second World War, that is, the form of it, it is necessary to grasp the fact that England passed into the American sphere of influence not after, but before the war. In 1942, a member of Parliament stated that it appeared to him as though England had the choice of becoming an eastern outpost of America or a western outpost of Germany. His statement did not cover all the possibilities and was imprecise, but it was at least based on the political fact that England's independence and sovereignty had ceased to exist. English independence began to dwindle away from that moment in history when the English policy sought to preserve rather than to enlarge the overseas empire. That, I think, is worth remembering. Inwardly, this point was reached when England's conservatism, which had formerly meant respect for the past, shifted to hostility towards the future. The establishment of American hegemony over the island could be proved by citing documents, diplomatic agreements, overseas telephone conversations, and the like, but such things, indispensable as they are to the historian, the journalist, the armchair politician, are all quite unimportant from a larger point of view. For the great indisputable facts of politics present themselves show sufficiently the underlying power currents. Neither power nor its movements can be concealed. What are those facts? The aim of politics is to obtain power. As we have seen, an elderly organism aims expressly at maintaining the present circumference of its power, although the precondition for maintaining power is the acquisition of more power. From the actual nature of politics, and accordingly one could also say from the nature of superpersonal organisms and the human beings in their service, it is evident that a political unit must not recklessly enter upon a war that cannot increase its power. To the entire world it was obvious that England could not have increased its power through a war against Germany. A war that a political unit is not capable of pushing through to victory on its own cannot increase the power of that unit. The term political unit is used here in the strict sense, of course, and that means a unit that possesses true sovereignty and thus has the ability to decide on its own initiative the war-peace question. Therefore, this term cannot be applied to areas like Brazil and Canada. If allies are indispensable, not merely practicable and useful for bringing the war to a victorious conclusion, then these allies will be the real power beneficiaries of a successful war. The term allies describes only other real political units which can make the war-peace decision on their own initiative, and here too, areas like Colombia and South Africa are excluded. Obviously, not even with the remnants of its empire and with its dependencies, France and Poland could England have defeated Germany. It must be assumed that what was known to the entire world was also known to official circles in London. Nevertheless, in September 1939, England began a war against Germany. After the American declaration of war in December 1941, it was officially admitted in England that the primary goal of pre-war English diplomacy had consisted in winning American military aid. What was not admitted, but was just as notoriously certain at the time, was that England's war declaration had been made, first, with complete and unlimited confidence in America's assistance in every form, second, to carry out a policy that had been set in Washington and that in no way meant the continuance of English national policy. It does not matter who begot the miscarriage called collective security, in quotes, a mixture of legalism, naivete, stupidity, envy, and senility. The fact is certain that only two powers in the world benefited from this policy, Russia and America. The government in London did not willingly favor Russia, but it worked, with full awareness of what it was doing, under pressure from the Washington. Okay, let's reread that paragraph again. It does not matter who begot the miscarriage called collective security, a mixture of legalism, naivete, stupidity, envy, and senility. The fact is certain that only two powers in the world benefited from this policy, Russia and America. The government in London did not willingly favor Russia, but it worked, with full awareness of what it was doing, under pressure from the Washington regime, exactly according to its instructions. The salient point here is that this fact, although satisfactorily proved by war memoirs, confessions, documents, and such, is manifest in the great decisions themselves. By way of example, if a power enters a war that it cannot win militarily, and that would not cause any power to accrue to it even if it did win a military victory, it requires no searching through history books to know that power is not acting in its own interests. In other words, it is a protectorate. From the standpoint of the Washington regime, the remnants of the English state were useful as a means of entangling America in a war against Germany, according to the 1916 formula, and the English island was valuable as an unsinkable aircraft carrier, quote-unquote, in the words of the American General Staff, likewise as a conduit for men and material. In these events, the relationship of England to America did not differ essentially from that of, say, Poland or Serbia. The Washington regime had England just as much at its disposal as it did Poland and Serbia. Only the strong power in a coalition can be said to have allies. The others merely are allies. In 1948, the post-war French government officially appealed to America as the, quote, ally of France. This appeal requires no explanation. History consists of the ridiculous as well as the sublime. A state that needs allies can never obtain them. It can become the ally of another more powerful state and fight for the increase of that power, but the state that needs to ally is the subordinate one. An alliance is never the sentimental grouping of a club, dripping with friendship, that the journalists are wont to make it out to be. On the contrary, every alliance has as its basis protection and obedience. Taken strictly, Washington and Moscow had no alliance during the Second World War, since the relationship showed no obedience, to be sure, on the part of Washington regime, or showed obedience, to be sure, on the part of the Washington regime without protection, which is a corollary of authority, on the part of Russia. In a protection-obedience relationship, the protectorate is within the sphere of influence of the protector, and therefore must obey it. However, America's self-robbery on behalf of the Russian war effort was thoroughly voluntary, even though it was in complete opposition to America's national interests. 2 degrees of political stupidity are to be found in diplomacy. The first is short range. Lack of political skill, inability to carry on any negotiation successfully, and to recognize short-term advantages. The second is long range. Lack of political farsightedness, ignorance of deeper power currents, and the ponderables of the becoming. These two kinds of political stupidity stand in the same relation to each other as the military stands to the political. The military is the weapon and the servant of the political. Only disaster can come of military thought dominating political thought. Win the war can never be an expression of politics, for politics is concerned with identifying the power currents, choosing the enemy, and weighing in relation to the national interest all happenings, inner and outer, according to how the war develops. To elevate the slogan, win the war, to the rank of policy as America did during the Second World War, is the equivalent of saying that there is nothing political about the war. Military thought is simply not political thought. The permanent ambition of all military thought is to win a military victory. The corresponding ambition of all political thought is to win more power. That may or may not be implicit in a policy that seems to desire military victory at whatever cost, for one can probably adduce just as many historical examples of political and military victory occurring separately as of both coinciding neutrally. Likewise, if short-range political thinking constantly prevails over the long-range in the policy decisions of a state, the only possible result is that state's political extinction. No matter how skillfully executed its political maneuvers, if a state has ignored the larger power currents in puzzling out its policy, it will suffer a political defeat. All these explanations and definitions apply only to real political units, for the microscopic destinies of such dwarfish states as San Marino, Monaco, and Belgium are completely dominated, or determined, by the destinies of the true political units, the great powers, as the diplomatic concert of the 19th century like to call them. The Polish officials of 1939 were politically stupid in the first sense. Their country, encircled by two great powers, had just concluded a non-aggression pact Their country, encircled by two great powers that had just concluded a non-aggression pact, they nonetheless chose to enter upon a war that would mean for it direct permanent political extinction in the least desirable form, occupation and partition. Actually, it is pure charity to call the political dealings of those officials stupidity instead of treason, for shortly after the beginning of the war, they disappeared, going abroad to live in the capital they were able to amass owing to their policy. Treason and political stupidity are closely related to each other. Interesting. That's an interesting statement. Treason and political stupidity are closely related to each other. As used here... Oh, no. Got lost there for just a second. Treason and political stupidity are closely related to each other. In the Proclamation of London, it is stated, treason is nothing but incapacity when it becomes resolute. As used here, the word treason refers to treasonous conduct on the part of individuals. An individual may be able to better his personal economic circumstance through an act of treason, but no group, no class, no organic stratum within a country is ever able to better the power position of the country through a large-scale act of treason. In this sense, all treason is political stupidity. The English officials of 1939 were politically stupid in the second sense, in that they completely failed to identify the larger power currents and likewise totally lacked statesmanlike feeling for the definition of enemy. The enemy is the state that one can defeat and thereby gain more power. Thus, military victory over an opponent whose defeat proved so costly that one must take in the bargain of a greater loss of power elsewhere must be called political defeat. These English officials approached diplomatic preparations for the Second World War according to the old tried-and-true methods. They attempted to isolate Germany, concluding whatever possible war alliances with Germany's neighbors, the peace front. They counted on American aid, trusting in the Washington regime's assurances that it would be able to lead America to war, despite the geopolitical position of America, despite the unanimous opposition of the American people, despite the conflict between intervention and the national interests of America, and finally, despite the fundamental spiritual indifference of Americans towards even a victorious war against Europe. The question they failed to ask was, what is the final political aim? Or in other words, how will England's power be increased through a victorious American war against Germany? Had they asked this question, it would have been obvious to them that, since England could not win this war alone, any extension of power derived from a defeat of Germany would be for the benefit of America or some other power. The result of their failure to ask this question was England's total defeat. But I think more realistically, they were already under the control of the Jews, who were knowingly operating in their own interest to increase their own power exactly in the way that he says. And I think all subsequent history has shown that to be the case in England, that they were already taken over by Jews who, if the leaders were not Jews themselves, they were owned by Jews, as Churchill was. That's why they did what they did. They knew all this, but it wasn't a miscalculation or stupidity. It was that they didn't represent whom they ostensibly did, and literally did. The suicide policy of the English regime in 1939, it was continued throughout the war, has various roots, and the ultimate explanation of it will keep scholars and archivists busy. The essential facts are already well known. First, political stupidity alone is not to blame. Some members of the government were consciously and deliberately pursuing a policy that was not pro-English, only anti-German. Second, some members of this regime were not officially part of the government, indeed, not even part of the English organism. He means they were Jews. Third, and most importantly, with Joseph Chamberlain, the rich political tradition of England had been laid to rest. The succeeding statesmen were of lesser caliber, class warriors like Lloyd George and MacDonald, pure egotists capable of representing any alien interest, like Churchill and Eden, even obsessed psychopaths like Duff Cooper. Thomas Hardy did well to introduce the spirit of irony into his Napoleonic drama, The Dynasts, in which the paradoxical and ironic make up the favorite conversation of Cleo. How ridiculous in retrospect now seem the efforts of these officials in London during the period from 1939 to 1941. They sought to drag America into the war. In reality, the war was from beginning to end a creation of the Washington regime. If it ended in victory, victory could only mean an increase in power for that regime or some other political unit, but in no case for England. The English nation was impressed into the war as a vassal that had been made to believe it was acting independently, and it emerged from the war with every characteristic of a colony. Only the definitive legalistic formulation was wanting. Those at the head of the London regime who were honest, if also stupid, schemed to use America for their purposes. And precisely because of their scheming, they were used to forward the ambitions of the Washington regime. All right, the next and last chapter of the first section. Stronger power currents in the age of absolute politics. Before the First World War, the most comprehensive single power current in the world was the movement of power out of Europe to the colonial areas, to America, to the Far East, to the Near East, to Africa. Power is spiritual in origin. That can mean only that Europe, seen from without, from Asia, Africa, and the Americas, was in spiritual decline. England was the nation that was custodian of the destiny of Europe. Then custodian of the destiny. He's saying that World War I showed to the outer forces of the outside world or the third world that, look, these guys have lost their mojo, as they always say nowadays, and they're in decline, and we are waxing and getting more powerful. England was the nation that was then custodian of the destiny of Europe. Other European powers had far-flung possessions and interests in the world, but none other than England could boast of a world empire. To the outer world, England was the West. However, the English national idea had been completely fulfilled in the course of the 19th century. The English nation, as distinct from the English people, was too used up and too worn out to bear the burden of the destiny of Europe. This fact could not be concealed, and so the scales of power between the West and the outer forces tipped over more in favor of the outer forces. Thus, it was England's political weakness that ignited the Asiatic masses' anti-European will to annihilation. In 1900, the English Empire, including the seas on which England was indisputably supreme, covered 17/20 of the surface of the earth. To maintain this structure in that form, the entire political strength of Europe would have been needed. Joseph Chamberlain's project of an Anglo-German partnership was based upon this insight. Other political minds that had the art of empathizing correctly apprehended the power current at the time, and the whole world was familiar with the expression Kaiser Wilhelm coined for these stirrings, the Yellow Peril. The great fact of the Yellow Peril dominated the political world picture before the First World War. Within Europe, the great power current went from England to Germany. The lesser powers, France and Austria, were both in the process of dissolution, and both passed into vassalage. Austria to Germany, France to England. But already England had entered the organically inevitable stage in which power moves according to the laws of centrifugal force. Power currents move from England to the strongest outlying powers, to Russia and in Central Asia, to Japan and in China and the Pacific, and to America in the Western Hemisphere. To Germany, Japan, and America, England gradually lost position in world commerce, and on the seas it had to yield to the same three political units. The metapolitical explanation for the intra-European power current from England to Germany is simple. The decline and inevitable demise of the English nation idea was part of the development of Western culture from the first phase of civilization, the age of economics, to the second phase, the age of absolute politics. It was destiny that England, the nation with the stateless articulation, to which the ideas of predestination and laissez-faire had been given, to which they were instinctive, to which expansion meant a business-like plundering of the conquered territory, with as little political disintegration as possible, was the guardian of the Western civilization during the 19th century. Likewise, it was destiny and not chance that the coming to an end of that age of liberalism, parliamentarism, economics, laissez-faire, and trade imperialism also meant the coming to an end of England's power. The New Age, the age of absolute politics, in which politics rules unconditionally over every aspect of life in the Western civilization, demands a different type of nation, a different internationale, a different universal hypothesis to fulfill the cultural mission of the 20th century and the centuries to come. The Prussian-German nation is that one of the Western nations whose national idea thoroughly corresponds to the cultural imperative in this age of absolute politics. For the solution of its tasks, this age demands the old Roman virtues, a soldierly ethos and honor feeling, political organizatory talent, firmness, conscientiousness, devotion to duty, will to power instead of will to plunder. Since the Prussian idea agrees with the spirit of the age, power flows organically, naturally, irresistibly to the focus of this idea. That a general war would break out, all statesmen and political thinkers were agreed. Only its form was not foreseen, nor could it have been. The natural form corresponding to the power problems posed by the power currents would have been England and Germany versus Russia and Japan. Since England and Germany belonged to the same culture, capital C, and had a common destiny, capital D, as they always shall, any war between these two states had to benefit powers outside Europe to so great an extent that neither one of them could have profited from it, and that quite independent of which side won a military victory and which suffered a military defeat. Therefore, it was in the interest of each of the two, for its own well-being, no less than that of Western culture, to undertake power struggles only against extra-European forces. After the war erupted into a false form, that is to say, into a form that in no way corresponded to the power problems posed by the power currents, the outward movement of power from Europe was vastly accelerated. The European Raj in India was undermined, Japan was freed from all fetters to Europe, and left with America as its sole power rival. America became the ruling power at sea, despite the five-power naval treaty of 1921, under which it scuttled 750,000 tons of new shipping. That folly hardly changed anything, since because of America's increased ability to build ships, which may be ascribed to the war, because of the powerful spiritual impetus of the war, because of America's awakening from its century of isolation, an isolation comparable to that of a silkworm in its cocoon. After the Bolshevist Revolution of 1917 and the consolidation of the Asiatic Moscow regime, Russia entered the political world as its most secure power. In Europe, France inherited the continental hegemony that England had striven to take from Germany. Germany lost power, true. However, England lost even more. It shared in the local military victory as part of a world coalition and paid for it with a general political defeat. With results, England had applied the great fundamental strategy precisely in reverse. It employed all its strength on inconsequential points while reserving as little of it as possible for the decisive point. Vis-à-vis the colored Asiatic world, England was still the custodian of the destiny of Europe, to be sure, now more enfeebled than ever, a pale shadow of the imperialist England at the time of the Silver Jubilee of 1887. England no longer had the feeling of mission, no longer felt called upon itself to rule. One no longer spoke of an empire but of mandates. It no longer believed in itself. Even domestically, England was in moral and material chaos. The war had resulted in the New Age with its new values and the discarding of much that was formerly significant, and the old idea of parliamentarism and laissez-faire was ineffectual in this bewildering new state of affairs. A superpersonal idea that has fulfilled itself can evolve no further. In a healthy organic evolution, England would have adopted the new superpersonal idea the new hypothesis and been absorbed into the new Internationale, but the catastrophic form of the First World War prevented the normal evolution. The West was not represented before the world by a powerful, firm alliance of England and Germany, militarily and politically victorious over Russia and Japan, but by a superannuated English capitalism. Had the war assumed the organic form, an English-German coalition against the rising Asiatic menace, it would have ended in a European victory and brought the whole planet under the influence of Europe. But in the form events took, the West lost so much of the 17/20ths of the surface of the Earth it had controlled that only about 4/20ths remained subject to it. And so the two great power currents continued unabated, the centrifugal current from Europe to the outer forces and the centripetal current from England to Germany. Power in embryonic spiritual form streamed from England to Germany. All Europe looked increasingly to the Prussian ethos for guidance. This idea gained irresistibly in moral force, strength of its inner imperative, and cultural prestige. Within Europe, another lesser power current flowed from France to Italy, this time actual political power. The source of this current was the genius of a single man, Mussolini. He effected the transformation of Italy by infusing it with the Prussian-German socialist ethos. Since the petty nationalism of the 19th century had not yet been overcome in Italy, as elsewhere, Mussolini was forced to associate his new state-building ethos with the name of Imperial Rome. Italy and the entire Western civilization have no inward connection with Imperial Rome, nor did it stand in any relation to them. Therefore, it may not be amiss if the true inspiration of his genius is mentioned here. Mussolini himself designated Nietzsche and Sorel as the two teachers who had inspired him. Both were opponents of laissez-faire, both were anti-parliamentary, anti-liberal, anti-democratic. Both had strong authoritarian leanings. The centrifugal power current from Europe, outwards, flowed more strongly to Japan, Russia, and America. Weak heads in England looked disconsolately to the American colony, symbolized in its spiritual endowments by its politically moronic leaders like Wilson, Lansing, and Harding, and hoped for spiritual leadership and material support from it. That kept on even after Americans demonstrated loudly and clearly that they were quite indifferent to European politics, as their Congress showed when it refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles and thereby rejected membership for America in the League of Nations. In consequence of the longing for American domination on the part of a certain group of Europeans, especially numerous and influential on the island, the totally altered American leadership that resulted from the American Revolution of 1933 found an open road to the financial diplomatic conquest of France, England, and the Netherlands. Thenceforth, America intervened in all inter-European affairs, always with the intention of promoting the same negative policy, meaning, quote, collective security, unquote, which can be called both anti-German and pro-Bolshevist. And then the rest of this chapter and this first section that we're doing will be a bunch of dates. Here are outlined the epical events of the interbellum, the in-between wars, period, 1919 to 1939. We got 2 pages of this, 2.5 pages. Versailles dictate, French hegemony established in Europe, Spengler's work, Preußentum and Sozialismus appears, Prussianism and Socialism. Mussolini, that's 1919. 1921, Mussolini emerges in history. The first open revolt in Europe of socialism against capitalism, of authority against money, of faith against criticism, of discipline against laissez-faire, of duty consciousness against the ideology of happiness, of hierarchy against equality, of the will to power against the will to plunder. That's all 1921. So 1919 Versailles, then 1921 Mussolini, and the sort of reversal of values of the spirit of the age of absolute politics versus the spirit of the earlier age, which was economics. 1923, France invades Germany. High point of France's power in its domination of continental Europe. 1931, collapse of the international financial structure of capitalism. Economic catastrophe resulting therefrom. Economic depression throughout the Western civilization. And also, Japan successfully raises its claim to power monopoly in the Far East with its annexation of Manchuria. 1931, that is. 1933, on 30th January, the European Revolution, revolt of the spirit of authority against money, of socialism against capitalism, overthrow of 1918 pseudo-victory of capitalism. And also the American Revolution of 1933, so twin revolutions in 33, assumption of power by the Jewish entity, and there he says it overtly, not culture distorted, he says overtly Jewish, assumption of power by the Jewish entity, lasting transformation of American policy through abandonment of nationalistic isolationism and the introduction of an internationalist policy, formation of the Jewish-American symbiosis begins. Also, end of French hegemony over Europe. 1936. Four Power Pact. England, France, Germany, and Italy forever renounce waging war among themselves. The first collective attempt to form an organically determined European imperium. August, September. America successfully intervenes to prevent the ratification of the Four Power Pact, to abort the European imperium, and to make it possible a Second World War in order to destroy the power of Europe and to forestall the rise throughout the world of authoritarian socialism to the detriment of finance capitalism. Also this same year, 36, this is the year in which the English Prime Minister Baldwin made his statement about the dependence of England and France on America. Last page. 1938, Munich Agreement for the pacification of Europe. The four powers act together to end Czech domination over Germans, Slovaks, Hungarians, and Ruthenians. Joe Sobern was a Ruthenian background, something that no one's ever heard of. Last of the great European efforts to overcome petty statism and to establish a provisional European imperium without an intra-European war. American meddling in England succeeds in annulling the mutual English-German renunciation of war and forces a reorientation of English policy towards setting up a war front against Germany. 1939, formation of the Peace Front, a war alliance of the Americanized England against Germany as a diplomatic preparation for the Second World War. September, final success of the American policy. Outbreak of the English War against Socialism and the Reawakening of Authority. 1941. Attack on Russia by the Provisional European Imperium. The war gains a second aspect. November. The Washington regime presents its war ultimatum to Japan as a means of provoking a Japanese attack that would facilitate the intervention of America in the European war against the wishes of the American populace. And December, Japan responds militarily to the ultimatum, whereby the Washington regime knows in advance the time and place of the attack. Complete destruction of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor by Japan, this because the Washington regime deliberately delays every defensive measure. America declares war on Europe. Europe becomes the chief enemy and is designated the main front of the war. As the war expands, and is designated the main front the war expands into and shows itself from a third aspect. So that's kind of the timeline he has of the events of the interwar period. Anyway, that'll do for today, and thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do part two of The Enemy of Europe. As always, find everything we do at vnnforum.com. Talk to you later.